The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So, good evening. So, tonight I'm going to talk about a story that has this tremendous backstory in the commentaries, which I'll just give a little bit about, but something that I'm learning about just available, I don't know, half a year ago or something, are these new translations in English of the commentaries of a particular book. So what do I mean by commentary? Is that the words of the Buddha as preserved in the Pali Canon, kind of the scriptures, and then roughly speaking about 1,000 years later, somebody kind of embellished, well, this is what was really meant, and gave these really colorful backstories about why the Buddha happened to be particularly there talking to this particular person or something like this. So it's kind of fun for me to look at these. It's fascinating, actually. So this particular story is when the Buddha talks to an ogre. So this actually is in the discourses in the Pali Canon. So the Pali word is yakka. A yakka is like a demon or an ogre. And some of them are practitioners of Buddhism who follow the Buddha, and they behave just like humans primarily. And some of them are evil, terrible beings who eat human beings. So there's a mixture of them. And they only show up a few times in the discourses. And they have a particular role, that is, they ask questions that the Buddha then answers. So we can consider them as just literary figures as a way to give an opportunity for the Buddha to speak, or you can hold it however you like. So this particular backstory to this one is a little made me smile, because it felt so familiar to think that, you know, this is like 1,600 years ago. This is a long time ago, right? More than 1,000 years ago. How they're setting up the scene here, I can imagine happening today, like literally today. So here's a little bit of the story. So this is not in the discourses. This is from the commentary. So there was this ogre, this yakka. His name is Alavaka. And he had the habit of eating human beings. And the Buddha wanted to convert him away from these evil ways, so that, to help him, so they would stop doing this. But at that time, Alavaka was attending a meeting of ogres. This for me is kind of funny to imagine. Like, what do they talk about? Do they like fight over, I thought you were going to send the agenda, or, you know, something like this. So, but the Buddha goes to his abode where he lives, and the doorkeeper, the gatekeeper of his of the ogre's home, says, "Well, it's actually not such a great time to be here, because Alavaka isn't here." And the Buddha responds, "But yes, but if it would not be burdensome for you," talking to the gatekeeper, "I would like to stay here at Alavaka's house." And the gatekeeper says, "It will not be burdensome for me, but you must know that this ogre is really rough and harsh, and he does not even pay homage, doesn't even respect his parents." And the Buddha responds, "Well, I know his rough character, but that will not be an obstacle for me. So if it's not burdensome for you, I would like to stay here." And the gatekeeper responds, "It's not burdensome for me, but I shall let you know that this ogre, this yakka, is like a hot frying pan. Not only does he not have regard for his parents, but he doesn't have it for religious mendicants or the Brahmins, or for the Dharma. And in fact, when other people have come here, he has driven them insane, or split their hearts, or he has grabbed them by their feet and hurled them across the Ganges, the river, maybe a big river. Buddha responds, I know. But if it wouldn't be burdensome for you, I'd like to spend one night here. And then the gatekeeper says, well, it's not burdensome for me, but actually, if I allow you without informing the ogre, then he will kill me. So please let me inform him. And the Buddha says, doesn't say anything, and then the gatekeeper goes off to this meeting of the ogres to tell his boss that the Buddha's back at his place. So that's the backstory of how it happens that the Buddha is at the place where this ogre lives, and the ogre is not there. Now we get to the actual teachings that are in the discourse of how this happens here. The sutta begins, thus have I heard, as most suttas do. On one occasion, the Blessed One, the Buddha, was dwelling at Alavi, the place where the yucca Alavaka stayed. Then the yucca, the ogre, approached the Blessed One and said, to him, get out, ascetic. So the ogre is just addressing the Buddha by calling him ascetic, a generic term for just a mendicant. So he's not using a term of respect. He's just saying this, get out, ascetic. All right, friend, replies the Blessed One, and he goes out. The ogre says, come in, ascetic. The Buddha responds, all right, friend, and he comes back in. For the second time, the ogre says, get out, ascetic. For the second time, the Buddha responds, all right, and he leaves. The second time, the ogre says, come in, ascetic. And the Buddha responds, all right, friend, comes back in. A third time, same thing happens. Fourth time, right? So here's the Buddha. He's going in and out. He's following the bidding of this ogre. The fourth time, the ogre says, get out, ascetic. And the Buddha says, I won't go out, friend. Do whatever you have to do. So he just draws the limit. Okay, I'm done with this. We're not going to do this anymore. So then the ogre says to the Buddha, I'm going to ask you a question. If you won't answer me, I'll either drive you insane, split your heart, or grab you by the feet and throw you across the Ganges. So this is what ogres do, I guess. And the Buddha responds, I do not see anyone in this world who could drive me insane or split my heart or throw me across the Ganges. So the Buddha's saying, yeah, I don't think you can do that. I'm not afraid of you. And you're essentially, these threats are empty. Nevertheless, so here are the questions that Alavaka asks the Buddha. What is a person's best treasure? What, practiced well, brings happiness? What is the sweetest of tastes? Living in what way is one's life called the best? So, Alavaka's first question, what is a person's best treasure? For me, it's interesting that he's using this word person. He's an ogre, and he's asking, what is a person's best treasure? But treasure, we can think of, you know, something we value, wealth, possessions. But the word treasure often implies things that are hidden or can be or like a resource, like a treasure, right? It's something that's like a buried treasure or something that has a particular, we have a particular attachment to often, to treasures, a fondness to them or something about this. But with this question, it seems like the yoga ogre, just like us, he's concerned about wealth or security or, you know, having some possessions that make him feel better think many of us can relate to this. Lavaka's second question is, what well-practiced brings happiness? He's interested in happiness just like we all are, right? We all want to find a way to have some ease, have some well-being, have some happiness. And this idea of it being well-practiced, what well-practiced brings happiness, for me suggests that the Alavaka has already figured out that things that are easily gotten don't really bring happiness. Right? If he has these powers that he can throw people across the river or split their hearts or make them insane or something like this, he probably has the power to get whatever he wants easily. So now he's asking, so what well-practiced brings happiness? His third question, what is the sweetest of tastes? So he's interested in pleasure. He's interested in what's pleasurable? What's a nice experience to have? We could think of this word taste as experience. So what's like one of the most pleasurable experiences? And the last question is, living in what way is one's life called the best? So Alavaka, he wants to know, how can I have a good life? How can I understand what is the best life? Maybe so that he doesn't have regret at the end of his life. Maybe so that he doesn't miss out on things that are better than what he's doing. We don't know exactly why he's asking this. For me, I thought I had this funny idea. Well, maybe that's what the meeting of the ogres was about. It was about these questions. And then when he came back and saw the Buddha, he said, oh, well, maybe I'll ask the Buddha. Right? We don't know, right? And then it's kind of for me, it's interesting to think about, like, okay, what was going on there and who are these individuals that are asking these questions and that are getting these particular answers to? So just like us, the ogre is concerned with things like wealth and happiness and pleasure and having a good life. So we could listen to how does the Buddha respond to these questions? So the Buddha says to Alavaka, faith is a person's best treasure. The Dharma, practiced well, brings happiness. Truth is the sweetest of tastes. And living with wisdom, one's life is called the best. So the Buddha is pretty straightforward. He's just says things. He doesn't give a long discourse. It's not a very complicated. He's highlighting these four qualities: having faith, practicing the Dharma, having a commitment to truth, and living with wisdom. But we can ask questions. Right, these are so succinct. We can ask questions of, well, have faith in what? And what do you mean by the Dharma? And what do you mean that to practice well? And what do you mean by truth? Does that mean like just saying the truth or discovering what the truth is? And if wisdom is important, how do we gain wisdom? How do we acquire wisdom so that we can live with wisdom? So these specific, the details of these answers aren't in this particular sutta, but there's a hint here. And that is, we could also ask, so the Alavaka asks, like, what is the best treasure? And faith is the best treasure. Well, why isn't wisdom the best treasure? Why isn't the Dharma the best treasure? Why isn't having a commitment to truth the best treasure? Like, why are they matched up in this particular way? And it turns out, if we look at this, so there's these four qualities that the Buddha's giving in response to Alavaka's question. Having faith, practicing the Dharma, having a commitment to truth, and living with wisdom. There's actually an order in these. There's a number of lists in the Buddhist world. For those of you who are familiar with the Buddhist teachings, you know there's lots of lists, like Four Noble Truths, Five Faculties, Seven Factors of Awakening, Eightfold Path, right? A lot of lists. A number of them have faith in them. Many of you may be familiar with the Five Faculties that begins with faith and ends with wisdom. One thing about all lists, whether they have faith in them or not, they're always in a particular order. They're always taught in a particular order, and the scriptures are always in a particular order. There are seven different types of lists in the suttas that have faith in them. They all start with faith, and they all end with wisdom. So this idea that faith is a starting point, but things end with wisdom. Some of these other lists are not so well known, for those of you who are curious. There's like the five factors of striving, which I'll just say has faith, health, honesty, energy, and wisdom. Or seven good qualities, which are faith, kiri, and otapa, which are like fear of doing wrong and regret when one does wrong, and learned, being learned, 1, 2, 3, 4. And you know what? I forgot the last one on the list here. Nevertheless, so there's a number of lists, and they all start with faith and end with wisdom. So we could look back at this list that the Buddha gives to Alavaka. These four qualities: having faith, practicing the Dharma, having a commitment to truth, and living with wisdom. And in fact, this list of four is outlined in another sutta where another rude person talks to the Buddha. Sometimes we imagine that it's the Buddha is just giving a discourse and his monks are happily listening. But sometimes, right, there's these interesting, colorful conversations. So in order to help understand the Buddha's teachings to Alavaka, which were given in verse and very succinct, we can see where he gives essentially the same teachings in another setting that is more fleshed out. So this is a setting where the Buddha is giving a talk to a number of Brahmins. So the Brahmins were of the dominant religious culture of the time, and they were the priests of the dominant religion at the time. Brahmanism. It's kind of like proto-Hinduism. And he was having an amiable talk, quote-unquote, with very senior Brahmins. So he was talking with the senior leaders of the community. And the conversation was continually interrupted by this young person named Bharadwaja. And the Buddha rebukes Bharadwaja. He says to him, "Let not the venerable Bharadwaja break in and interrupt the talk of the very senior Brahmins while they are conversing. Let the venerable Bharadwaja wait until the talk is finished." Earlier in the sutta, we hear that Bharadwaja is 16 years old. So he's a young person. And there's this meeting of the elders, and this young person keeps on interrupting. But then the most senior Brahmin turns around and says to the Buddha, "Let not Master Gotama," so he addresses him with a term of respect, Master Gotama, unlike the ogre who just called him an ascetic. "Let not Master Gotama rebuke the Brahmin student, Bharadwaja. He is very learned and he has good delivery. He knows how to speak. He's wise and he is capable of taking part in this discussion." So the Buddha looks over at Bharadwaja. Bharadwaja catches his eye and decides, "Okay, I'm just going to speak directly to the Buddha then." And paraphrasing, essentially what he says is that their Brahmanical teachings, which are preserved in their scriptures, the Vedas, are true. and only they are true, and everything else is wrong. Right? So he's saying, you know, our religious traditions are true, and yours are wrong. That's just the way it is. But after some querying, the Buddha asks Bharadwaja some questions, and Bharadwaja, and the Buddha asks this young Brahmin student, well, does anybody have direct experience? Do they actually know what these teachings are? Or is it just because they're in the scriptures? And it becomes clear that nobody actually has direct experience of what they're talking about. They're just in their scriptures. So they all believe it to be the only thing that's true and everything else is wrong. So, and they, and Bharadwaja says, well, we have faith in these teachings. And the Buddha responds, well, something may be fully accepted out of faith, yet it may be empty. It may be hollow, and it may be false. Whereas something else may not be accepted out of faith, and it may be factual, true, and unmistaken. Right? We know this for ourselves, right? Just because we believe something doesn't mean that it's true, right? It just means that we believe that it's true. It means it actually is true. So the Buddha says to him, so if you want to make assertions based on your faith rather than on your direct experience, it's not proper for a wise person, for a person who wants to, has a commitment to truth, to come to the definite conclusion that only this is true, anything else is wrong. But instead, if a person has faith in something, a person could just say, my faith is this, I believe this. Instead of making the assertion, only this is true, everything else is wrong. And this young Brahmin guy likes this. He thinks this is very interesting. He says, but how can I discover what is true then? You're telling me if I'm just saying, if I have a belief, to just state that I have a belief, but how can I discover what is true? How can I know what is true? And then the Buddha gives him a teaching. So first you can investigate a potential teacher to see if they exhibit any signs of greed, hatred, or delusion. So these are some of the roots of which kind of like underlie all of our unskillful activities. Wanting something, not wanting something, or, you know, being confused about it or having some ignorance. The three unwholesome roots, greed, hatred, and delusion. So if that teacher doesn't seem to have greed, hatred, and delusion, then you place faith in them. And you listen to what they have to say. Because you have faith in them, you pay attention to what they have to say. And then you hear their teachings. And then you reflect and consider the teachings. And then when you feel like you have a practitioner has a reflective acceptance of the teachings, that is, as they have considered them, zeal just naturally arises. This is a fun word, kind of like zeal, right? A certain amount of energy arises. Oh yeah, this makes sense to me. This is consistent with my experience. It doesn't seem crazy to me. So then with that zeal, they put the teachings into practice, and to practice with diligence, some heartfeltness. And then when you practice with some diligence, then you can discover the truth for yourself. Just like the teacher doesn't have greed, hatred, and delusion and gives teachings, if you follow the teachings of a teacher with zeal and diligence, you can discover the truth by having greed, hatred, and delusion also going away. And then when you're no longer obscured or not able to see, or not able to see clearly because you're seen through greed, hatred, or delusion, then you can come to the truth. And they say that you can discover the truth by penetrating it with wisdom. And I'll talk about this in a little bit. What does this mean to penetrate with wisdom? And then the final arrival at truth lies in the repetition, development, and cultivation of these. Right? It's not just doing things once, but doing this repeatedly, seeing things again, thinking about them again, practicing more and more. I think all of us have this experience, right? The more that we practice or investigate or consider, then it becomes richer and richer, and more aspects of it become relevant. So in the Buddha's response to the ogre, he said, faith, practicing the Dharma, a commitment to the truth, and living with wisdom. So we see how that kind of is that same story gets played out here when the Buddha is talking to this young rude Brahmin. But then there's this question about wisdom. Well, truth, wisdom, discovering the truth, does that mean that you have wisdom? What does this mean exactly? And to help answer that question, we can go back to the sutta, where this ogre is talking to the Buddha. And and Alavaka says to the Buddha, how does one gain wisdom? Pretty straightforward question. I think it's a great question. How does one gain wisdom? Yes, a few other questions too, but they're not as relevant to what we're here. They're off on a something else, as sometimes we find in the suttas. So I'm not going to bring those here. And the Buddha responds to this question, how does one gain wisdom? By placing faith in the Dharma of the awakened ones, just like we heard in the earlier sutta. And from a desire to learn, one gains wisdom. So this desire to learn, that is this willingness to listen to what the teachers of the awakened ones are saying. And if one is diligent and astute. So diligent, right? Being committed to the practice or not giving up when it becomes difficult. And being astute, that is paying attention to when what a teacher is saying doesn't make sense. When it seems like, oh, maybe there is some greed, hatred, or delusion here behind it. Or also astute can be with some mindfulness too. It's like to really be paying attention, and not only with our minds, but also kind of with our bodies. Does it resonate, or does this seem like something that doesn't quite resonate, doesn't seem quite right? So with some astuteness. So when the Alavaka hears this from the Buddha about how to gain wisdom, we don't know exactly what happened, but here's how he responds. Indeed, for my sake, the Buddha came to my home. Today I have understood where a gift bears great fruit. So now I will travel from village to village, town to town, and pay homage to the Buddha and to the excellence of the Dharma. So he becomes converted, right? So the Buddha came there, gave them a little teaching, and something clicked in him with this teaching, and his mind changes. I love these stories a lot, actually. This idea that faith is just a place where we start. Faith is a placeholder. Not that we're not being asked to believe some doctrinal thing and hold it dearly. We're asking to say, okay, I don't know, I'm not sure, but I'm willing to investigate. I'm willing to look at this some more. I'm willing to see if there's something here. And specifically, we're asked to have faith in the teachings of those who have gone before us, those who have more experience. We're not asked to have faith in the fact that there's ogres and the suttas here or anything like this. First, we investigate. Does it seem like there are people here that don't have greed, hatred, or do they? Are they kind-hearted? Are they generous? Do they seem like they are see things clearly? Investigate. That was the first step before placing faith. I think kind of in the secular world today, and I know for me, this was really meaningful for me. And then it grows with wisdom, right? It's then the next step after that is to like put things into practice and to have our own direct experience. It's not just about believing beliefs, but to put into practice what the teachings are. It's kind of a unique thing about Buddhism compared to a lot of the other, compared to all theistic religions in general, I'll say, this very gross general statement, that Buddhism is more about orthopraxy rather than orthodoxy. So orthopraxy is what do? What do you practice? Whereas orthodoxy is what is the doctrine that you believe. So here is this, we're being asked to roll up our sleeves and engage with the teachings, engage with the practice in a way that we can find our own ways to happiness, pleasure, certain type of wealth, and living with wisdom. So that we can find, you know, these things that all of us are looking for, either overtly or indirectly or covertly, all these different ways, right? We all want some happiness and ease and well-being. And so much of what the Buddha's teachings are about this, like how can we find them? So with this teaching with the Buddha having the starting with him going to see if he can convert this particular being who is happens to be doing evil things, doesn't get much more literally evil or clearly evil as eating other human beings, right? So it's very it's not complicated. It's very clear, very straightforward. So maybe in the summary, I could like wrap this up is to all of kind of the Buddhist practice is to one is to start with, you have to have a little bit of faith because you don't know everything yet. So I have a faith that it's worthwhile to investigate. That's all that's being asked, is that's that type of faith. And to investigate to see if what you're following makes sense and if there isn't greed, hatred, and delusion. So the best of your ability that you can determine. And then second is to practice the Dharma well. And what does that mean, to practice the Dharma well? So the Dharma, we can understand in this setting, is the teachings of those who have wisdom, who don't have greed, hatred, and delusion. And also to practice is to have a commitment to discovering the truth. Discovering the truth. To have some diligence. It's not always easy. I think we know this for so many things in our lives, right? Some of those things that are worth having are not easily gotten. Doesn't mean no pain, no gain. It just means that sometimes it's frustrating. Sometimes it's painful. Sometimes it's confusing. But to have some diligence as best we can, you know, with compassion too, right? And to being astute. What's really happening? What's really being taught? Can we be present? Can we learn for ourselves? We don't have to kind of just blithely follow along, but to bring all of our faculties with us as we do this practice. So to have faith, practice the Dharma well, and then to discover the truth and gain wisdom. Kind of a summary of the Buddhist path here in this brief little teaching that the Buddha gave to this alavaka, the yaka. So I think I'll end there and open it up for questions or comments. Yeah. Oh, yeah, so penetrating with wisdom. Thank you. So what does it mean to have wisdom? Yeah. So the Buddha, how does one gain wisdom? It's the same idea to penetrate with wisdom. It's like to see with wisdom. And here the Buddha uses these words. He essentially points back to the teachings that were in the earlier sutta. In order to penetrate with wisdom, it's the same thing as to discover the truth. That is, in order to penetrate with wisdom, you have to practice the Dharma, practice well, and that allows wisdom to arrive. So discovering the truth and penetrating and having wisdom turn out to come together and be the same. In some ways makes sense, right? I think this is what we would, in our conventional use of English, we would understand that. So thank you for that. Any other comments or questions? I can repeat her question. I can repeat it.
Could you repeat that? Because I can't hear
it. Yeah. So she asked me, do the commentaries say anything about why the ogre converted? Just on, like, you know, seeing these words. No, they don't say. It's more about what's implied is just the power of the Buddha being there, and somehow the ogre sensing this, what it meant. I will say this, what the commentaries do say, if part of the reason why the Buddha wanted to go see the ogre, I told you that little story he had with Geki, but why he went is because the Buddha, with his powers, whatever those might be, sensed that the ogre was just ready for an awakening. So sensed, for whatever reason, how that was, that he was open to hearing a teaching. So then he went to give him a teaching.
Could you talk about conversion a bit?
Yeah. It's kind of an odd word, right, for us to be using kind of in the Buddhist context. There's a number of stories of this in the suttas where there's individuals who are doing bad things. Some of you may know the story of Angulimala, who's this mass murderer, who the Buddha also goes. So the idea is more about for practitioners to stop doing evil, which is such an odd word too. Maybe I'll say to stop harming others. And instead to see that there is a benefit in doing the Buddhist practice. But there are a number of different ways in which people they convert. So one, they just become a follower of the Buddha. And what that means is that they will give alms to some of the Buddha's followers, to the monks, and maybe take refuge in the Buddha, Dharma, and the Sangha, if that means something to you. To take refuge is to say, okay, I'm going to use the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha, so the Buddha, his teachings, and the community of followers. To take refuge is to say, I'm going to organize my life that to be consistent with what's the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha. So it doesn't necessarily... Yeah, I'll say that. So that's kind of a lay follower. That's one way to convert. Another way to convert is to ask to become a monk or a nun underneath the Buddha. And to, take on robes and practice in that way. And then there's a third way in which practitioners just agree to, maybe they don't take refuge in the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha, but they agree to support those people who are supporting the Buddha. So there's a number of different ways in which individuals kind of respond to the Buddha's teachings. And of course, there are some individuals who just walk away too. Don't do anything. So thank you. Yeah, right. We can imagine that these have been passed down. Well, that's the tradition says, right? That they've been passed down for all these generations. So only those stories that make the Buddha look good and the Buddha's teachings look good are going to be preserved, right? So the other ones we don't have doesn't mean they didn't exist or, you know, we just don't know, right? So. Okay, so thank you for your attention. And I'll stay up here if some of you would like to talk to me, but otherwise I wish you a wonderful evening and may you find something to place faith in so you can investigate and practice well and discover the truth and gain wisdom. Thank you.